Greetings, fellow investigators, and welcome back to our video podcast, Into the Darkness, where my friends and I play the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. I'm your host, Tom Rayleigh. Our campaign is Beyond the Mountains of Madness, and this is episode 17. It was written by Janice Hill and Charles Engen, along with others who are listed in the credits. Our GM for this campaign is Sean Little, and Mick Swan will be giving the recap. The characters are suspicious, the players are ready. Let's begin our journey into the darkness. Mick?
Thank you, Tom. I must confess that I'm starting to harbor doubts about the professionalism of this mission. There is, as far as I can see, no real chain of command, and that is fast becoming an issue. Starkweather is focused on fame and glory, more for his part on the pursuit of knowledge, and while eminently worthy, he's no more useful than the preoccupations of his partner. Certainly they can appoint tasks, they can give us jobs and directions, but neither man is a leader, and that runs the risk of creating a power vacuum. Previously, this has only been a minor issue, compounded somewhat by our unification with the Lexington Expedition, but overall manageable. The unexpected arrival of the German expedition at Miss Lexington's bidding has cast a very different light on matters. The Germans have displayed precisely the kind of professionalism which threatens to usurp Starkweather and Moore's authority, and given the uncertainty which surrounds their motives, I worry that they may be in a position to exert undue influence over our expedition. For the moment, however, things seem cordial. They're well equipped, and I was interested to see high altitude equipment among their inventory. Furthermore, they produced an ingenious new ice-cutting device which enabled them to excavate the hangar at the lake camp. After several hours' work, it was possible to enter the canvas hangar beneath the ice, where we found further grisly dissections, more dogs by the look of it, mutilated with that same unnerving precision. Vital organs laid out in some sort of grotesque mandala around them. Their brains sliced paper thin. Here and there, the marks of cleats in the ice betrayed the fact that the rescue mission must have searched through this place. On seeing this gruesome sight, the German professor is moved to invite us back to his camp. He has, he tells us, something we must see.
Thanks, Mick. All right, so you walk back to the camp, I assume, following Professor Moore and the leader of the Germans. And Professor Moore and he go into a tent. He says, I need to speak to him in private briefly. There's a lot of quiet discussions. You can hear, if you listen quietly, you can hear the sound of paper rustling. And then another bit of silence. And then thank you very much. Thank you. I'll see to this. Thank you. And Myers comes out and says to you, Professor Moore is going to need a little bit of time, but one or two of you may speak with him for a moment if you wish. He says that just to send in a couple of you briefly, and then he'll give you instructions from there.
What in the? I'm going to go in.
Okay. Anyone else?
I'll go in.
Mr. Moore, what's going on? Please.
I've just been handed this packet, and you see one of those corrugated cardboard manila or cardboard folders with a flap. The string that ties it shut, he opens it, is a document, and it's a good 100 pages thick. He says, this was intended for my reading, apparently. It's the dire text, if you have any comprehension of what this may be. This is the summary of the notes taken by those in the rescue party who came to Lake's camp after the fateful situation that had occurred. And it's going to take me some time to look this over. So I'm going to take some time. Could you please return to the hangar areas that they're excavating and assist as best you can, because now the Germans need to take their rest break and they're on a different time than us. I'm going to go through this, summarize it in my mind, and see what I make of it before we speak to anyone else of this. So please don't mention this to anyone else. I will, I'll summon one of you afterwards to discuss it with. Thank you.
All right. So, Nigel, what do you think? I mean, how did the Germans get a hold of this?
You know, I don't know. Why bother calling us in here if we're not supposed to discuss it? Why couldn't he have just left it secret?
Well, maybe it's Moore's decision to keep it to himself first, and then, I don't know.
Somebody needs to learn how to lead.
Well, this whole thing, we could have just come here and done what we were supposed to do. And now it seems to be all, you know, screwed up with these other people involved.
I am not happy about the Germans.
The fact that the Germans, the Lexington group, it's like there's too many chiefs running this whole thing, and they're all over the place.
Well, it's crazy.
So we walk back to the others. Well, they're outside, right? They're just outside.
Yeah, we're just outside the tent. Yeah.
Moore's got some sort of document that the Germans gave him that apparently is something that Professor Dyer wrote during the last expedition. And he's going to go over it and summarize it for us. And then he's going to share it with one of us.
I think the big story here is, how did the Germans get a hold of that?
Exactly what I'm thinking is, how did the Germans get a hold of this?
I was going to say, why wouldn't Moore have this?
There's too many things that are going on behind our backs that I'd really like to know the answer to. I feel like the honesty level here has not been the disclosure. Nothing's being disclosed to us.
In contact with the Germans and the...
Well, we know Lexington has.
Yeah.
The Germans figure into this in some major way. They're not just bit players. They seem to have information. They seem to have information that they really shouldn't have, that we should have had.
I'm starting to think that what we thought were going to be three completely separate expeditions to the Antarctic, completely separate, completely funded separately from different parts of, you know, well, in our case, from different parts of the country, but they're a completely different country. I'm starting to think that there was some collusion going on here.
I think it's turned into a race. I think that everybody's here for something, and I know Dr. Meyer, and I know that there's something else going on here besides philanthropy and knowledge. They definitely want knowledge, but to what end?
I was going to say, they probably struck a deal with the Germans, whoever got there first or something, you know, about working together so they're not stabbing each other in the back.
One thing's for sure, whatever the expedition started as, it's no longer that. It's right. Once we found the creatures in the ice, it became about that. And now everybody's wanting in on it.
Gregory, do you want to do an idea roll?
I will be glad to do an idea.
Gregory, Phil, sorry.
Yep. Idea... No, I do not have any ideas at this moment, I'm afraid.
Okay.
I just think that, you know, I think that Nigel is correct. I think this is turned, and Dr. Lindenbrook, I think you're correct as well. I think that philanthropy has kind of gone out the window, and now I think it's almost a race.
Well, we knew We knew when this whole thing started, because Starkweather and Lexington were involved, that this was about publicity. Neither Starkweather nor Lexington are real scientists.
No.
That they were hoping to make fame out of what we did as scientists.
Right.
Which is fine, because
they have access to checkbooks.
Yeah, and they, the kind of fame they want, nobody is going to, all those things that we discovered in that cave, nobody is going to put Starkweather's name on those things. Those are going to go down as scientific discoveries by the scientists who discovered them. But he'll get in the newspapers, he'll get on the, they'll probably make a film reel about the expedition.
And I'm fine with that, because that's the more fine, publicity yeah. he gets, the more people are going to want to fund our research. And like you said, we're going to be down here for decades.
You want to know what the really, you want to know what the really scary part is, Gregory? You said this is a race. We're sitting here looking over the find of the century. We're looking over body upon body of a creature that, as far as we know, has never existed before. So if this is becoming a race, what more are they looking for that we don't know about? What are they not telling us?
Probably something that's detailed in that document that Moore is reading right now. And I've got to admit, they didn't have to share it with us.
Absolutely not. Unless there's some sort of leverage they can use against Starkweather.
Well, let me ask the GM. Who was in the tent with Moore just now?
It was Meyer.
Dr. Meyer.
And Dr. Meyer is a scientist, yes?
Archaeology.
Okay. See, here's the thing. You can expect a certain measure of collaboration between scientists, because that's what they do. He may have given that document to Moore because he is a scientist and not a publicity. For all we know, his higher-ups don't even know that he gave that to Moore. You know, because why would you? If you have the key to something important, why would you give that to another person, unless you're a scientist and you want to collaborate with?
I'm not going to argue that you're wrong. I would just simply propose that I think the Germans are too well organized and disciplined to let something like that accidentally fall into the wrong hands. I think that if we have it, it's because they wanted us to have it.
Well, what they give it to Moore. Moore is a scientist.
What if it's fake? What if it's a forgery? What if they're deliberately trying to mislead?
Well, that's an interesting idea, but it would take far, far less energy to just not tell us anything than to create an elaborate, you know, 200-page hoax. That's probably not what's happening. My guess is, scientist to scientist, they're just cooperating. Moore is a scientist. He's not really like Starkweather at all.
Well, Dr. Meyer and I run in the same esoteric circles.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm keeping my eye on him. I trust him as far as I can throw him.
Well, I spoke to the archaeologist as well, and he seems to be, I don't know how to explain it. He seems like a scientist to me. He's more interested in the discovery than he is in putting his name on things.
Oh, this is definitely all about knowledge, whether it's occult knowledge or what. That has yet to be seen. That card hasn't been dealt yet.
What do you say we get on down here to the hangars and see if we can dig out some more information from there?
Oh, yeah, so they should be through cutting that ice back by now.
It's so bloody and gory. Ugh.
All right, so we head to the hangars.
All right. Well, the Germans, when you arrive, they are essentially closing up for the night, because for them, it's evening. They need to eat. They've been working at it all night. They've happily shown you how to use the ice knives, and they're leaving them in your care. And they say, look, if you have any issues, please feel free to give us a few hours sleep if you can. And we can help it, but I think you can go at this yourselves now. So leaving it up to you to.
How much did they get cleared? Have we broken through anything?
Well, the way they describe it to you, like they've cleared off the surface snow, and what they've described to you is from south to, well, I would say it's south north, really. If I look at the map, it's from east to west. The map that you have that shows the lake camp, that long strip, they've uncovered one section of that, and there are four actual sections when you look. So what they've uncovered would be, I guess, what you would call, on your map that you have with the numbering system that you had come up with, P2 is not uncovered. P1 is actually three pieces, and they've uncovered the one closest to P2. So there's three more sections that have yet to be uncovered, two at the bottom of the P1 larger portion, and the P2 section, which you already identified had a piece of an aircraft sticking out of it.
All right, well, dig in. Get to work.
How many of the knives do we have?
I believe there are four.
Okay.
Has our engineer had a good look at them and see if he can replicate?
Oh, yes. Lots of notes made, lots of... you couldn't replicate them with the equipment you have here, but you could hobble something together. But
well, for our next expedition, we'll have them.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll grab one, and I was watching them use it. I'll, you know, give it the old college try and get in there.
I'm keen to
make myself useful.
Rather exciting.
I'm sure a doctor can hear.
Dr. Hawks, should we test some of this effluence and see, I mean, at least what it looks like under a microscope? Dog blood cells, human blood cells,
alien blood cells. Sure, we should take samples of everything and test it out. So we can either gather up as much as we can right now, bring them back to the tent and check it afterwards. So,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, Doctor, you shouldn't be doing any like hard labor. You're a surgeon, so. You need your...
Don't worry about my hands. But for sure, I can gather as much samples here and actually go take a look at them right now if you want.
Well, you've been touching, poking at them, the little samples. One thing that you did notice, Dr. Lindenbrook and Dr. Hawk as well, is whether you wore gloves or whether your fingers were bare or whether it was...
Well, no... Yeah, always gloves. It's freezing. So
yeah, there's a dried sediment on your fingertips from touching these white circles now. And if you could both do an idea roll?
Powdered rock from them digging out.
Oh shit! 98. That's a fail.
Idea. I passed by 20 points.
It's it reminds you of a trip you made to New York City many years ago when someone was putting salt on their walkway.
Oh, okay.
Sprinkling crushed rock salt to break up the ice to make it easier to walk and do it downtown in some areas of New York where you had been. And it leaves the same sediment on your gloves as you saw in the gloves of the person who was doing it. So you smell it. It smells like salt.
Oh, were they attempting to take the meat and salt it and preserve it? That's something that you would expect from starving men. What do you think, Doc? Why the salt?
That seems...
Do we really want to know the recipe to Elder One jerky?
Dog jerky.
It beats pemmican.
And yeah, it probably does.
Probably does.
A little chewy, but... I guess the question is, who is doing this? If it was the men who were here and they seemed to have all been slaughtered, All right, we keep coming back to that horrible idea that these things were intelligent and alive, making themselves clothes and taking dried food or salted food with them. Why? Where were they going? Did they leave the camp and head back? Did they think they were still in the Cambrian age and they were... I can't imagine what's going on here.
Could I try another idea roll, Sean?
You can. Sure.
A 9.
Well, what are you trying to conjure up an idea about, just so I can be more clear?
Okay, using the salt with the meat and everything like that, okay, there would have been a timeline, how long they could store stuff like that. Can I try to...
Well,
I gather something from that?
You know, salt can be used to melt ice. And there's an area, there's a number of these areas that there's a little white circle, and then there's this pink ice. And when you touch the white circle, you can detect salt on your fingertips. With a good, yeah, it's a good roll. I'd say it's almost like something was on the ice. Salt was sprinkled on it or laid on it in some way, shape, or form. The ice melted, and then whatever's there has been removed because there's an indentation where something was there. Yeah. It's not there anymore. And all around it is this pink frozen ice. Like, you can preserve meat with salt, but generally it's in a drier situation.
Yeah. Sure, Dr. Lindenberg, what I think they were trying to use the salt to kind of, thaw some of the ice around some of this.
Maybe they were just trying to accelerate the thawing process.
Yeah.
So something that was here had already frozen up. Do you think this would have been in the Dire group? That they were trying to get something out of the ice that was frozen into it by the time they got here. They were the rescue party, yes?
Yeah, yes.
Is there, can we see what the shape is that was in the ice? Is there any?
Yeah. Let's just say, I have to go ahead here and find where this
is. Could I ask a question about the cleat marks that we saw before?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, I hate to jump in, but it's sort of germane to the question about the shape. In trying to apprehend the shape, do the cleat marks go inside it, or does it look like they were walking around something?
They're all over.
No, okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. Like, the cleat marks are over top of all of this.
Okay.
Now that you've noticed them and pointed them out, you see them everywhere.
So what shape is it?
If you give, you want to give it a good look, people shaped. It's bigger than a dog.
So there was a person frozen here, and they melted him out, then probably buried him.
Yeah, well, the red would maybe suggest bleeding?
Slaughtered? Like the other things.
I'm just finding it very difficult to kind of come up with a timeline here, the kind of the difference between the Dire party and the original party, it's kind of hard to kind of figure out who did what. Or am I the only one that has that problem?
Well, according to the newspapers, the information that we got,
I understand that. I mean, what's happening here at this camp?
In this camp.
You mean the lake camp? The frozen camp?
Right.
Something happened in the lake camp.
Definitely.
Dyer's party got the distress calls.
Yes.
They came.
Yes.
And when they got here, they found this nightmare.
But they didn't contribute to it.
As far as we know, they then continued on somewhere. There's a period of time that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. And then they ended up back in Boston, stark raving mad.
Well, right. I think we can assume that the Dyer expedition were responsible for burying the bodies and constructing camp as well.
And their airplane made it back. So they flew their airplane from here to somewhere and then from somewhere back to the ship. Mm-hmm. And in the interim, they lost their freaking minds.
Right, because I seriously doubt that in their mental state that they could fly.
Well, this could have seriously damaged their
oh yeah,
seriously damaging ours, but yeah. they were also rational men. I mean, we know what war is like. We know that there is slaughter and nastiness out there. This is going to give us nightmares for a while, but it's not going to shatter our sanity.
Can I question something, Sean?
Sure, absolutely.
William Dyer was part of the original Lake Expedition, wasn't he?
Yes. Well, the Miskatonic Expedition, yes.
And then we're talking about the Dyer rescue mission. So is that the same Dyer? In other words, he was with the lake, he returned back to America, and then he came back a second time to rescue?
No. As you understand things from the newspaper reports and such and documentation and information you gathered, the parties, it wasn't one large expedition where everyone stayed together.
Right.
So the Lake Expedition went forward, opened up the underground such. They had this camp. Something happened, and the Dyer group, which was Dyer and the rescue party, came from a base camp or a previous camp, returned to the lake camp to try to rescue, to find any survivors.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So they were both part of the Miskatonic expedition.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes, yeah. There's the lake camp, the Dyer rescue team, and the Miskatonic expedition is the whole bunch of them.
Got it.
One other question I had. The description you're giving about this ice with the salt and the pink stuff, that was like within the hangar, say?
Yes.
So at some point during the first or second, whatever you want to call it, expedition, this should have all been covered with canvas. I'm just wondering how something was frozen in here unless it was either found here and then the canvas was put on top of it.
Well, I can tell you that based on what you're seeing in discussions with the Germans and the people who've been in the tent in here all night long, is that this was a tent. Something horrific happened inside the tent. And the temperature within the tent was still below freezing. I mean, there's no sign of any heating units or furnaces or anything like that. Something horrific happened in here. And the best guess you can make right now based on the information you have is some things, probably dog-shaped, human-shaped people, were on the ground. Something about salt melting the ice, and the humans are not here anymore, but there were dog bits and pieces over to the far side of the tent. So you could take a guess that maybe the rescue team, because the cleat marks are on the floor, perhaps they were removed.
Yeah.
Hmm.
According to the report, what they thought happened to Lake before the rescue party got here was that there was a terrible storm. In fact, it was a storm that came up that started the whole thing. And then they lost communication. Dire's party got here. Now, yeah, it would seem that the slaughter happened at that time. The tent may have partially collapsed. Everything froze. The Dire party got here. They used salt to get the human bodies out and then buried them at the cairn and then went on from there.
I would disagree with that.
Why?
Because salt does not work at melting ice below a certain temperature.
Well, what temperature is that?
It's above freezing. I mean, not above freezing, I'm sorry. Above zero.
Well, if it's, what time of temperature is it right now outside?
Oh, God. I don't know.
Come on.
Nick probably knows. He's been to Antarctica.
I could.
What are the highs during the summer in Antarctica?
I don't know what. I'll have to tell you in Fahrenheit. Hang on.
That's good. I know Fahrenheit really well.
I don't. That's my point. Hang on. I'll need to find a converter.
Because we've seen grass growing. Which grass?
Well, not here. You haven't seen
minus 18 degrees. Well,
not right where we are. That's the highest temperature.
That's the average.
Yes, that's the average throughout the year.
That's in the month of January, which is when their expedition was there.
Ah, I've tried apparently to get into a university. You said I'm not allowed into. Okay. Yes. Temperatures, that is fairly accurate. Actually, January is actually one of the warmer times of the year. The dipping would be farther on in the year. So yes, it's entirely possible that it could have melted the ice under the right circumstances in a tent.
Can I also point out too that those creatures were found with mineral salts on them?
That's true.
But do we know if that's an excretion from the creature?
We don't know that specifically, but it does mention that the reason the mineral salts apparently preserved the specimens with minimal calcification.
Right, so that could have just been moisture from the cave that deposited mineral salts. So we were talking 600 million years, so mm-hmm. It could have just been excreted out of the air.
That would also fit in with a marine hypothesis, wouldn't it?
They apparently obviously can function both in water and out of water. Because if they were functioning here during Lake's thing, they weren't underwater.
No.
Dr. Hawk did an autopsy on them, didn't he?
We both did, yes.
Uh-huh. Did they have signs of gills or anything like that? Or did they have lungs? Or
I thought they had both, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. I imagine they had something that could be construed as that. I'm not sure that we could positively identify exactly what each organ did, but they definitely had something that looked like a brain.
Making educated guesses at this
point. Mm-hmm. I'd say they had to have some way of respirating.
Mm-hmm. You know what, since we're on this topic, I wanted to ask this earlier, but where, either drawing it on the ground or whatever, but where would the brain be located?
I'd say it was probably right in the middle somewhere.
I'm asking because I want to know where to aim.
Oh.
You got a harpoon gun?
In case they all come back to life.
Well, wait a minute now. This actually brings up an interesting situation. If we assume these things are alive and they are what attacked Lake's camp, that doesn't mean that they're not still around. We've seen fresh footprints. Well, we should be prepared.
Highest temperature recorded in Antarctica was 63 degrees Fahrenheit, 17.5 degrees centigrade.
It's probably at the coast.
So that's fairly
near, near the water.
Mm-hmm. And we are in the summer, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always got my rifle with me. You just don't want to wander around unarmed, I don't think, personally.
Well, yeah. There's vicious penguin things living here.
Them Germans look shifty.
The Germans, yeah. No offense to the Germans, just it's part of the game.
It is the 1930s.
It is the 1930s.
I am a German, so I have immunity.
I'm 12.5% German, so I also have immunity.
I'm a Heinz 57, so there's German in there somewhere, probably.
You're a mutt.
All right.
All right, so we're still cutting on the hanger here.
That's any help.
I'm sorry,
have we made any progress on the hanger?
Yes. Assume that as you're deliberating, you are actually chipping away.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So which, it doesn't matter. Which, let's assume that you have already opened hangar one, which doesn't matter which position it is in. Give me a hangar number. There are four in total, and I will move on to that.
Four.
Two. Four. Okay.
Huh. Just pick one. I don't care.
And all Sean has to do is just rename a number two, number four, and then.
That's right. So we're going with number one, right? all right. Let's just assume that you do actually decide to go towards the one that that has the aircraft sticking out of it.
Okay.
Now, when you move towards that, you know what? It's an irregular mound of hard-packed snow. It's like the rest of it. It's just snow piled on top of something that's above the level of the normal ground. It's slightly different than the rest, however, because 5 feet of airplane wing is sticking out at a funny angle from it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Nigel picked that out before anyone even noticed what it was, being a pirate. There's a foot or so of tail empennage, seen at one side. I don't even know what that means, and I do speak a lot of French. All of the exposed metal surfaces are brilliantly shiny now that the wind has blown off the paint, sandblasted with ice over the years. The lee sides, there's lots of icicles sticking out about 4 to 5 inches, some at strange angles because of the wind. That once you start to clear it, once you start working, you notice right away that a lot of the shelter would collapse before being buried under the snow. So when they dug away the snow, it was more of an indentation than the previous one. You cut away with the knives where you need to, and you find inside that the airplane is crushed beyond repair. The port side wing and the flattened landing ski are buckled. The fuselage is crushed and twisted.
But does it look like the plane was crushed by the snow?
Well, it's been crushed by falling blocks of ice, you think, because there's a bit of a drop, but you're not entirely sure. Tarpaulin on the base of the wing is all that really remains around the base of the wing. But if you you have a pilot aircraft, does someone else not have operate heavy machinery?
I've got both.
I think I've got heavy machinery as well.
Mechanical and engineer, electrical repair too.
Okay. Well, could you both make a roll then?
Against what?
I have 1% if that helps.
Against, Sean, against what?
Your pilot aircraft. Just your knowledge of aircraft.
Didn't you take any classes while we were traveling across?
Made it.
Okay. And Mick, did you want to do your heavy machinery one as well?
Ooh, that's no, I made a mistake there. I haven't got operate heavy machinery. I was confusing that with mechanical repair.
All right. How well did you do, Nigel?
I made a critical. An 06.
Oh.
An 06. And my skill is 70%.
You just walk in and go, look at that. what... Right away, you can see that not only has the engine compartment been opened, like there's actually latches and hooks. It hasn't just been busted open. Something has actually opened the engine compartment completely. You notice inside that not only are some parts missing completely, not on the floor anywhere, not in the engine compartment, not sitting at the bottom, parts are missing. Parts have been loosened and put back in place properly, but not done up all the way. There's some places where components have been removed and other components been put in the holes that look like they should fit, but they don't. It's like,
all right,
it's,
so basically someone took it apart and didn't know what they were doing, put it back together.
Yeah. Somebody was, it's almost as if a child took an engine apart and tried to put it back together. That's the best way you can describe it.
What is it with these things? Apparently they're trying to learn.
That's exactly what I was going to say. You hit it right on the head.
They're trying to learn.
They're trying to learn. They're trying to mimic.
They're dissecting our animals and us, apparently, to learn about our bodies. And then they're taking machinery and pulling it apart and to haphazardly putting it back together again. They're making coats. Whatever this thing is, I think that it's highly intelligent, or at least it leans towards intelligence of a magnitude greater than a caveman.
No, this just keeps getting creepier and creepier.
Mm-hmm.
Do we see any of the footprints around here?
You do see some of the little chip marks, the cleat marks from someone actually having walked around, which you assume is part of the dire rescue party.
Yep.
But that's all you really see.
Okay, so we're not finding, but they could be obscured easily with all the falling snow and all that kind of stuff. That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can't salvage the plane, so they're not going to do us any good.
You know, I have an observation that may put a stopper in the idea that these creatures were doing any of this. We found no evidence of any kind of limb, like an arm or a hand. They seem to have a wing-like structure in the back and some sort of I'd almost call it like a branch in the front, but the top of the thing, which looks like a starfish, is eyes and mouths, and the base is some sort of tentacle-like things, but they're for locomotion. It doesn't seem to have any kind of manipulative structure. So how could it hold a scalpel? How could it undo screws and put screws back on? I don't. There's something we're missing here.
Good question. I mean, we have no clue as to what these things are capable of unless we saw one alive and mobile.
In action, yeah. We would need to see one.
But it makes no sense for a human to disassemble a plane, considering that the plane is their lifeline.
Unless they've been infected with something that has driven them nuts, and not having, for instance, if I were driven nuts, I might try to figure out how the plane's working because I have no working knowledge of aircraft.
Mm. Can you tell with the airplanes? Can you tell if tools have been used to take it apart, or, you know, if this was caused by some sort of, you know, this intelligent creature, or if it was done by
some of the things that have been taken apart would require a tool.
I'm sorry, two of you were talking at one time. What was your answer, Sean?
Some of the components that have been adjusted, removed, replaced would have required a tool.
So the question is how could the creature, well, let's say it was 600 million years ago, even know which tool to use or how to use the tools or what the tools
are? What if the creature, well, I would say that it's a matter of hit and guess. I mean,
well, if I saw a spanner inch, I would have no idea what it does.
This creature is learning about us. So he picks up one, that doesn't work. He picks up another. I mean, he had plenty of time.
Did they?
Yeah.
But the paper thin slices of brain would indicate a high level of precision.
There's, I think that we should just wait. I think that our speculations may be premature. There's something that we're missing. I mean, this is wild speculation. What if these creatures were somehow telepathic and they could force the humans to do the job for them, but they didn't quite know what to force them to do?
Well, that's a possibility. I don't really deal with that realm. I don't know that much about it, but I would say that with a creature that's this old that we have no knowledge of in our fossil records, I'd say that they could be capable of pretty much anything.
Yeah, and if with a large brain such as that and no way to manipulate the world around them, what if that's their means of manipulating? What does Gregory, what do you say? What do you think?
I was actually going to bring up the exact same thing that you did because, you know, it's a good point that they don't have, they only have locomotion, they only have rudimentary mouth, eyes, but no opposable thumbs to use the tools. So I think we're on the right track, but I also think we're, it's, you know, maybe we've had a little bit too less sleep. We've had not enough food. You know, we've been working at this for 16 hours a day. I think maybe our imagination's getting the best of us.
Less speculation and more sticking to the facts.
Okay. You want to stick to facts? You don't want speculation. I have an interesting theory.
Which is speculation.
Fact or is it speculation?
No. We're going to turn speculation into a fact.
All right.
We have a number of bodies. Why don't we take one of these bodies and thaw it out? Between the Germans and us, if it is alive, we should be able to handle it. Let's take and thaw one out.
Well, I have. It's an interesting experiment. If these creatures that are buried were capable of coming back to life, wouldn't their companions have taken them with them, thawed them out and taken them? What if they're dead? I mean, the creatures can die.
Well, then...
Might I ask, Dr. Lindenbrook, in the course of your autopsy, was there any indication that any of the biological matter was still viable on a cellular level?
It was remarkably pliable, very tough, but that might be a question more for Dr. Hawks. Dr. Hawks, when we did our autopsy, was there any indication at all that the elder thing had actually been alive recently, or was it pretty much dead?
I think it was pretty much dead. Who was the other doctor who was helping us as well?
Oh, Dr. Green. Dr. Green. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think he would agree. Now, we don't know about all the specimens, but my guess is these look like they were buried. The way we would bury a dead person and put a cross on top, they buried their dead and put stars made out of soapstone on top.
Okay. If there are any of these creatures alive, the safe assumption would be that they live in the cave system.
Or they went somewhere, yeah. But they covered themselves up.
Why don't we go down in the cave system?
Once again, it's a speculation. We can't. We went down into the cave system, and when we got a little ways away, we realized there was no further we could go.
Okay, so the thing is, okay, so some of these creatures were dead and buried right here, but then we have bodies that were obviously buried, the planes wrecked. Was there a fight that broke out? Like, I don't...
If the creatures came back to life, they would have woken up in a world completely different than anything they were used to if they were if they grew up in the Cambrian, I mean the Precambrian age. Although I don't know if the climate would have been that different where we are right now. I mean, this is Antarctica. Continents don't move. That's just preposterous. I don't know. Once again, it's all speculation. We need to just wait. There's missing facts. When they fall into place, then we'll understand better what's going on.
Well, I'm just going to keep cutting through the ice on the hangar.
Let's see what else we find.
Let's see what else we can uncover here, because you know, we can either sit and lean on our shovels and talk about all this all day long, or we can get shit done. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I want to know what's in that document that Moore has.
All right. Well, it's taken you a few hours, and you can the next two hangars you can chew through pretty quickly. The next one, low amount of snow, not quite as high, but peak in the middle, 4 feet. Most of the snow has been cleared, but once you get inside, again, this one is filled with snow and ice. The tarpaulin's completely gone. And when you get inside, I mean, someone want to make a spot hidden? It looks pretty empty.
Ooh, sure. Made it.
All right. You've been looking around because you've been thinking about the aircraft engine being taken apart. And over in some of the snow, you see a single eye bolt and a pair of steel screws. I mean, they stand out because they're dark against the white ice. And I think they're from the engine. There's something that, you know, something had carried it over to this area. So it's part of the engine components moved over into another hangar area.
I'll investigate it.
Yeah, there's nothing more. I mean, this is literally all you find looking around. It's just a few screws and a single eye bolt. So
let's keep moving.
I thought you said eyeball.
I think just an eyeball. Just one eyeball and a couple of screws. Nothing exciting.
You hold up the eyeball and say, look.
The next hangar, again, I mean, and this is taking you guys a fair chunk of the day, but you've got some assistance. Low pile of snow, 4 feet high, wind ridge, same as before. Again, you get inside, there's nothing really in there. There's spare parts for aircraft, but none of these are of any use. I mean, it's just bits and pieces of the spare parts and tools and such.
Well, if this has taken us a while, too, the Germans will probably be waking up soon, so either we can work together, if any of us still have the energy, or we can kind of hand over the tools to them and have them do the last of the four.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is one more location as you're clearing out, I mean, before they wake up. Mm-hmm. There's a Dornier aircraft that it had been flipped over onto its back sometime in the past and sort of pushed up against the edge of the hangars. I mean, they cleared it full of the surface snow. And it's canted at an angle against the wall of the Hangar 3, I guess we call it. Mm-hmm. It's in the air.
That happened.
It's never going to fly again. All exposed surfaces are like pitted and paint's been blown away. Shiny and that, like the other aircraft wing and such. Window panes are milky and cracked. The interior is thickly packed with ice and snow. Like the entire aircraft, through all the little crevices, snow is blown in and filled the inside of it with snow. So it's all melted together in lower parts of the fuselage, just like a solid mass of snow inside the aircraft.
Now, Nigel, what could flip over an airplane like this? Strong wind?
That's what I was going to say, a gust of wind?
It would have to be a pretty strong gust of wind to flip over an airplane.
Well,
if they didn't have them tied down.
Antarctica has some of the strongest winds in the world.
Right. I don't think there's anything sinister here unless we can find some sort of
Is there any of these footprints?
No. You don't, because you're outside, any footprints would have been, you assume.
Is there any part of the plane that we see that looks like something grabbed it and crushed it and flipped it over? Or?
No, it really literally looks like.
Yeah, there's no way of telling without like some kind of a giveaway sign. It could have been the wind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. you know,
or falling ice.
Yeah, barring any evidence, we really shouldn't read anything too suspicious or sinister into this.
Well, the idea that these things could have flipped over an airplane when they don't even have hands. Yeah, I don't think so. Well, I don't think that we could flip over the airplane. So mm-hmm. all of us together.
Aircraft aren't really as heavy as you think they are, really, especially back then. Nigel, you just assume that just based on what you see, you've seen in places you traveled in the Eastern Seaboard aircraft that flipped over in just hurricane winds that have come up the coast before. So mm-hmm. it's not uncommon for aircraft to just flip and roll in really bad weather.
You know, on the Eastern Seaboard, I've seen some planes flip over, apparently.
I should have wrote that down for you, sir. But could everybody who is poking around the aircraft here, could you make a luck roll, please? I want to know who got the best roll.
14. Not a critical, but...
14. Oh! 92. 80, 20, 84.
51.
Nigel, that's a propeller.
As I walk into it.
Oh, it's so not running.
It looks like that? Dr. Lindenbrook had the best one.
I got a 14.
Okay. You're poking around the outside, and you're all thinking to yourselves that there's no way to clear the snow out of this aircraft without hammer and chisels. It would take days. You can't use the arc knife thing they've developed because it would... It'd probably damage the metal frame. And there's an acetylene torch you could use to cut through the ice. But it's back in the barrier ice. You're just all standing around going, how the heck can we get in this? And you can't see anything inside. And then your foot kicks something. You actually kick something on the ground. And when you look down, you brush away the ice. Nigel says, that's the radio. That's the aircraft's radio. But it looks strange.
Hey, look, that's the radio. It looks kind of strange.
Perfect. Perfect delivery.
He says it just like that, too.
It looks strange.
You didn't wait for me to say, hey, I just kicked something, and it looks like a radio. All right.
I was just following my cues from God above.
It looks different. This is the issue, is that it looks... Does anybody have an electrical repairer?
Yes.
Well, no, but okay. I did take the radio thing when I took class.
You want me to roll it?
Yes, please do, yes.
Oh, yeah. Another critical.
Okay. Oh, you go, look at this. Should I write it out for you? You notice
look,
right away.
Look, it's an 8-track player.
Damn, but I guess again. You look at it, and... It's been partially rebuilt using spare parts from other components. Wildly inappropriate. I mean, there's things in there. This is not a radio that's been built by anybody that knows what they were doing. But oddly enough, it looks like it. It almost looks functioning. The exterior, however, is really corroded looking. Like everything's, it's like the whole object was dipped into mild acid just to smooth out all the rough edges. As you bring it out, you brush it off, you bring it out to the sunlight, the closest dogs start to howl.
Turn it on.
Hey man, this radio looks like it's been disturbed. It's been put back together, but in a really unusual fashion with various other parts, and then it looks like it was dipped in acid to smooth it all down, and hey, it looks like it would work.
You know, I have the strangest feeling of deja vu.
Hold it up over your head like John Cusack.
Let's be brave and turn it on.
Well, the strange thing is, you don't see any power source, nor do you see any way to connect power to it, the way it's constructed.
Turn it on anyway.
There you go.
Seem to be reacting to it already. I hope it doesn't liquefy humans.
There's definitely a switch.
Silent hill radio.
Well, that's why Nigel's holding it, not us.
Hey, there's definitely a switch here. Let's turn it on.
All right.
Well, it doesn't function. It doesn't do anything that you know of. You're click, 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 click.
I'm going to keep this thing.
Great, Any Nigel. Reaction from the dogs?
They haven't stopped howling.
Okay.
Here's a question for you. So the dogs are howling. We flip the switch, and they're still howling?
Yeah.
Looking at the radio, I'm just making an assumption, but a radio from that time period makes a lot of noise, like static, the hum of the diodes. I mean, there's something that some kind of electrical sound coming from it, even if there's not a show playing.
Sure, the dogs could be hearing it on another.
Yeah, but what level. I'm saying is can I feel like vibrations? Can I hear any kind of electrical static or hum or anything that would denote that it was actually powered on?
No.
We can't. We got to figure out something to do with this because we can't take it back to camp. The dogs are freaking out already.
Well. Perhaps I just said that we shouldn't speculate. However, you could speculate that by flipping the switch, you just alerted them that we are here.
Good. Then they'll show up, and we will solve the debate once and all if these things are alive or not.
And then we'll be like the stuff on the floor.
But you'll have your answer. You're a man of science.
Yeah, I don't need that answer. I can just leave that answer.
I could retire happily not knowing that answer.
All right.
Hey, Sean, I just thought of another question. Yeah. In our investigation of this whole camp area so far, have we come across any weapons?
None whatsoever. You found bullets in one of the tents.
Okay.
What about shells of bullets?
There were a few locations, yes, where there were some spent shells, yes.
Oh, mainly okay. Places where there's blood?
Yes.
So they didn't go down without a fight. Now, the big question is, and here's one for you, Dr. Lindenbrook, since that you have the feeling that these things are not alive, if they were what killed Lake's camp, why didn't they take Dyer out as well?
Because they weren't here when Dyer got here.
No, he was on the rescue party.
That's right. That's what I'm saying is if they took out Lake, why didn't they come back and take out Dyer when Dyer was here?
Because they weren't here when Dyer got here. How would they know that Dyer was here? They finished what they were doing in this camp and left. We don't know where they went.
They went to the cave system. That's the only logical place they could have gone, unless they're on the top of the plateau.
That's where they could have gone to. That's apparently where Dyer was going to go. As far as missing all the weapons being missing, Dyer could have collected those. Remember, Dyer, we have plenty of evidence that Dyer and his people were in this camp.
Hmm.
So, it's possible that they found something that they couldn't understand and they did some of the dissection. We don't know.
Here's another wild speculation for you. Maybe there's no guns here because as these things were learning about us, they found out how to use guns and took them with them.
With their fingers and their arms that they don't have? How do you pull a trigger when you die? Yeah, I think that that's a wild speculation. And why would they need them?
Do we plan on exploring the mountains anymore and the plateaus? And
well, that's our next leg of the journey. But
right.
That's why I'm here.
It's only been a couple of days that we've been here.
No, we've been here weeks.
No, we've been here a couple of days that we've been digging these things out.
We've managed to dig out all this stuff in days.
Well, you were here.
We're very industrious.
It seems like weeks.
It's been like 4 days.
Yeah.
We have a magic blade that cuts through ice like a lightsaber, which hasn't been invented yet.
We arrived on Ross Island on November 13th, and I think yesterday was November 30th.
December 1st.
So about 2 weeks.
2 weeks, give or take.
Now, how long have we been in Lake's camp?
Oh, right. We landed next to the Leeds Camp.
No, we were exploring. We landed on the coast, and we were on the coast for a few days before we came out to here.
27th, you arrived at the camp. You arrived at the camp.
So 27, 28, 29, 30, 31.
5 days.
Like I said. Airplane guy. All right, what are we doing next?
It is noon, and it didn't take quite as long as, you know, some of it was a little easier than you would have expected. And had it been all cutting through the ice like the first hangar, you would certainly
have been going.
It's afternoon, slightly afternoon, and Professor Moore comes walking through the camp and is looking and says, he is muttering to himself, shaking his head. He's carrying that packet with him. Looking around, he seems to be not really. He's not taking in what everyone is pointing out to him that has been found. He's not really interested in casual conversation. But anyone, I mean, I won't make you roll for it, but you can hear him muttering things like "impossible." It's all here. How could it be? Why? Why would he lie? Why would he lie? And after a few minutes, he straightens up, and he says, "I'm sorry. I need to speak with Dr. Hawk, please." So he says, "This is imperative. I speak with Dr. Hawk."
I was going to say, "Do you want Dr. Leidenberg here as well? He's worked with me on quite a few things."
That's fine. That's fine. It's the two of you. The two. Yeah. I appreciate
it. It's important. You know, he should be in on this.
Yeah. No, I've spoken. And I'd like to, the two of you, please, if you could come over with me.
All right.
So could everyone else remove your headsets? And we'll give you the thumbs up when it's time.
Watch out for Mick, because he's stepped away before you said that.
Ah, where'd he go?
He said, "Be right back," but just watch for him to come back and then stop talking and tell him to.
Okay, I'll just click on his screen. Okay, so everybody else is gone? All right. He says, "I'd like you to look over this for me." He says, "This is an account written by my one-time friend, William Dyer. He writes about the 1930 expedition about..."
Oh, gross.
"Fantastic things. I don't want to say too much until you've read it for yourself. Just judge it with unbiased eyes, so to speak. I'd like you to look over this account for yourselves. I tell me whether you think it's genuine. Tell me if it's written by a madman or one who is sane. It's Dyer's work. I've read his papers, too often mistake his style, but look it over, please. It's a little long. It'll take you a few hours. It took me from breakfast till now. And speak with me at 5 o'clock. After you've read it, though, just now, I have to think about things." And he flips up his hood and walks off. He's heading in the direction of the burial cairn. And I outside of game, I'll send you the text. It's quite long. You can choose to read it or not, but there is a summary, and I'll send that to you as well. In essence, Dyer's story and historical accounts agree substantially up to the point where the rescue party lands at the Lakes Camp. Mm-hmm. However, in Dyer's writings, he explains that if they find the camp in a big disarray, much as it was found by you guys, murdered bodies of dogs and men scattered about the camp in the area of the hangar, hideous displays of them laid about. That the party was murdered was never in any doubt. The identity of the murderer was uncertain, but they thought it was Gedney, the missing student. Now, Dyer and Danforth, this is what they thought at first. Dyer and Danforth flew lots of flights of the air in search of Gedney, never found him. They took a single plane, lightened as much as possible, flew over the mountains to the nearest pass. On the far side, they found not a barren plateau, as some reports may have stated, but the incredibly ancient remains of an immense city inhabitable for geologic epochs. They landed, walked through the city, their edge. They sketched, they took photographs. The city's barren now, they said in their report, but contains murals, frescoes, things that show that the people who built this were
Mick is back.
Intelligent. Okay, Mick, you'll have to take your headphones off for a bit, Mick. We're talking something
secret.
Yeah, there you go. So he maintains the city was not built by men, but by the creatures similar in appearance to these elder things you've discovered.
Hmm.
And that the murders were not done by Gedney, as they discovered, but the eight perfect specimens that were removed from the cave by Lake's party. It seems they weren't dead, but somehow hibernating. They awakened, they slew the rescuers and fled over the mountains to the city home. The city is on top of the plateau, but also deep underneath the plateau is a great sunless sea, they're calling it, which may be reached by long tunnels slanting down from the surface of the plateau. Dyer said the city builders took their final refuge there. They think their descendants may live there still, but when they went down, they were set upon by a huge and monstrous predator that they refer to as a Shoggoth, from the frescoes and the information they could find, it appears to be a slave of these elder things at one point, but now they're free, and they're murderous. They escaped through good luck, but the shock of the meeting was one of the things that caused Danforth problems. Mm. Now, they say they found the bodies of the four of the returned elder things in the downward sloping tunnel, apparently killed by the Shoggoths. They conclude the rest most likely perished as well, seeking their own kind. This is their hypothesis. They found Gedney's body too, preserved and carried on as if they were going to examine it later in the city. So Gedney's dead. After they went through the city for hours, and they were chased by the Shoggoth before they examined the city, and they conclude the existence of the Elder Runes in the city is something that should be kept from the rest of the world. And because if the knowledge of this goes off, the world won't be able to handle it, essentially. They pledge to keep this secret, persuade others to stay silent about it. So they took lots of photos. They speak of lots of photos and samples, but they're not provided with the manuscript. And it's about a 3-hour read. This is how long you're going to be gone for. Unless you have any questions about it.
The Germans knew this. Mm-hmm. So are the Germans trying to reach this supposed city up on the mountains?
You'd have to ask them.
Oh. Wow. Well, I'll have to read this. This sounds wildly...
We're just getting this now.
Sounds like...
The Germans only arrived yesterday.
Yeah. It sounds like science fiction, but... I just can't stand the idea that Nigel might be right. All right, we'll read through this.
Okay. All right, you'll be gone for a few hours, so I'll bring him back.
Yeah. All right. Come on, Doc Hawks. Let's go discuss this.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds good. At least we'll get some answers here.
All right.
Don't come back. Oh, they're moving. Some of them are moving. Bill's coming back.
Well, I saw your text message.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Here we go. We're all back.
Oh, hang on. I've forgotten which function key unmutes my speakers.
Well, we can hear you.
Yeah, that's all that matters.
We can hear you, but you can keep looking if you would prefer.
That's it. I'll just type everything I say. Oh.
Okay, I've done it now. It's
we'll play by
F11.
All right, so they disappear. Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lindenbrook. They've been handed something. You all see this, and they're speaking amongst themselves briefly. And what do you two do with this? Do you say your goodbyes, or do you stick around, or do you leave? You decide what.
Well, we just go off by ourselves.
Yeah. Okay, so they've wandered off, and they are going to be gone for the rest of the afternoon.
However, it might be, we're not going to say this out loud, but the fact is, there's two of us and one manuscript. One of us will probably read it out loud to the other.
Yeah.
So, sneaky ears. Sorry. Didn't need to make that suggestion.
Well, I would like to have a little discussion with Moore.
I would like to go with him. Wait, so who just came and got Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lindenbrook? Was that Moore?
That was Moore.
And Moore, Lindenbrook, and Hawk just wandered off. Right?
No, we wandered off together. Well, Moore is still in his tent.
So it's just you two that wandered off. Okay.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So you wish to talk to Mr. Moore. He is available to speak.
So me and Elmer want to talk to him. You know, Mr. Moore, I think that the answer to everything is in the caves. We want to go back down in the caves.
But you've done your exploration of the caves. I thought you hit roadblocks. You weren't able to proceed.
We only went an hour in, turned around and came back. With a little bit more exploration, who knows what we could find. But here's the bottom line. These creatures came from somewhere and went to somewhere. The only place that's available for them to go to would be in the caves.
Mm-hmm.
We only went in one direction, too, didn't we?
Well, you wandered for an hour in a general direction. You didn't follow like one single path.
We were following the breeze. We were trying to figure out where the air current was coming from, if I remember correctly. And that really didn't lead to anywhere specific. We just basically went an hour out, and then we went an hour back.
These things were found in the cave.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yes.
Well, I have to speak to Mr. Starkweather. And it is evening for us. Some decisions are being made on where to proceed from here. So let's think about this throughout the evening, have some discussions after we have our dinner hour. Perhaps meet me in my tent for a drink. We can sit and discuss all of this terrible affair. And we can reconvene around 8 o'clock this evening, if that's acceptable.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. So it is definitely, I mean, he wants your report, though, Dr. Hawks and Dr. Lindenbrook. So now the afternoon is really busy work. And he's expecting you to meet with him at 5, an hour before dinner. So assuming you've had time and you have read through what you've been provided, he'd like to meet with you. But do you wish to meet with the others first, or do you wish to follow his instructions, or what would you like to do?
I think we should tell the others.
I think that we should be cautious about that at first. However, I do think that we should talk to Captain Sugden about the difficulty involved in getting up there. You know what I'm getting proposing?
Up. Mm-hmm.
Up to the...
Well, you guys can decide if you want to have quiet conversations in private, or what would you like to do? It's up to you.
Let's talk to Dr. Sugden, Captain Sugden, privately for a moment.
Okay.
So everybody else, take off your earphones. Not you, Sean. You don't.
Nigel and Gregory. Oh yeah, I don't have to. Nigel and Gregory, could you?
Okay, Captain Sugden. We need to talk to you a bit.
Yes.
As you know, or maybe you don't know, a manuscript was given to Moore that apparently was written by Dyer. And it says that after he left this camp, after he discovered the horrors that were here, they went up onto the plateau, which is pretty high up. He claims they found an entire city buried in the ice. And that the answers to all of this was up there. That they actually found access to this city and explored it for hours.
I see.
So our question is, how difficult is it going to be to get up there? What are we talking about?
Well, we potentially need oxygen. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what the the altitude is.
Have we flown over the plateau, or has anybody flown over it?
Not yet. But you do know that the bell left with Acacia Lexington. They've just left this earlier today to do a flyby along the edge of the mountains for some photographic purposes, but they can't fly over at present. They weren't there. Nigel knows full well that they haven't lightened the load enough, so to speak, to get over.
Would our airplane be powerful enough to fly up that high?
You'd have to ask Nigel, but that has always been the assumption that the discussions among the senior staff have been that the plan was to try to do that. Yes.
Well, okay. So once we get there, that's going to be a major exploration here. Like that's going to be.
You know, at this point, I think that you may be right, Doctor. I can see a reason to bring everybody in on this. We've got a surveyor, we've got an airplane, a pilot, and we've got an archaeologist.
Well, it's worth pointing out that I don't know how many sets of breathing apparatus we have.
Right.
But the Germans have 10 sets of very good breathing apparatus.
I was going to say, not only that, but for our own personal safety, having security or guards with us, like, obviously, well, whatever happened at the camp here,
we definitely need to be armed. So. Let's go ahead and bring in the others and ask their opinions before we go back and talk more about what we think we should do.
Okay.
All right, Nigel. We're bringing you in on this, as we are bringing in all of you. We need to discuss something with you, and we'd like you to keep it to yourselves. Okay, or at least we're going to watch your discussion in on this. We've read through the Dyer document. And what Dyer is claiming, he's claiming that up above the mountains here, on the plateau, there is an entire city buried in the ice. He said that they managed to gain access to it, that they explored it for hours. So as far as the reason why we brought you into it is, one, surveying. We need to actually know what we're dealing with. How high up are we going to have to go? How much oxygen do we need? We brought in the pilot because, will our airplanes fly up that high? Can we fly up there and land? Or do we have to climb up there? And, of course, the reason why, Gregory, we're bringing you in is because you're an archaeologist. If we found an entire city buried in the ice, it says in this document that the architecture is bizarre, strange. All the speculations are that it's built by these barrel creatures. Things.
Mm-hmm.
And that they had a whole civilization.
What, the things here with no arms?
Well, apparently they used slave labor to build it. And if we're to believe this, their slaves were a kind of gigantic amoeba-like structure that could change its body shape to create whatever tools it needed. And that they ruled our world for millions of years, 600 million years ago.
I didn't vote for them.
So
I don't think they were democratic.
Does this expedition have the blessing of Moore and Starkweather?
We're going to approach Moore next. He's asked what he wants to know our opinion of what we should do based on this document, and we needed your opinions. What's the feasibility of getting up there?
I'm assuming that I could make it in the plane, but I will tell you this, there's no way that I'm going to get up there without alerting everybody in the camp.
Well, we're not talking about a secret mission.
More soon, so
we're just talking about we're the first people that know about this.
Yeah, we could fly up there. Providing providing that there's good landing. That's the trick.
Well, it's described here as almost like a glacier frozen over with the city buried in the ice. And there's a few places where it sticks up out of the ice, which is where they found access to the city itself. Basically, they came in through a tower and worked their way down into this city.
I think the first thing we should do is just take a flight up and reconnoiter it from the air. I wouldn't land yet. Let's just verify.
I think that should be step one. Absolutely.
And then once we verify, then we come back and regroup and talk about how we want to really proceed. Because I don't want to rush into this unprepared without a great deal of thought.
Doing that would also give us an opportunity to use the altimeter on the airplane.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
To get an accurate reading of the altitude and know what we'd expect.
Yep.
Now the advantage that we have right now over the Germans is that they can't get up that high.
Well, let me take Elmer and Sugden on a flyby, and that way we can kind of chart, you know, kind of things like this, because I'm going to need to make sure that I can land safely and take off again.
See what's involved.
And how close we can get to the city, if we can notice it, if we can see it, how close we can get to the city without in land.
If what's to believe, if this document is to be believed, and realize that it may have been written by a madman, but if what here is to be believed, the entire plateau is the city. It's a vast, monstrously sized, a city that could compare to anything here on Earth, possibly bigger.
I think we should keep this under our hat. I don't think that we should take it outside this group, except for Starkweather and Moore.
Well, unless Moore, I'm not sure that Starkweather needs to be in this.
I could take the plane up, fly around to the back side of the mountain, and make my run from there, and then that way the Germans wouldn't see it.
Well, Lexington's already going up for a survey flight. It wouldn't attract too much attention if we all...
Lexington's not going up any place that I don't take her.
And, well, she's already gone.
They're already up there.
With their aircraft, yes.
Oh, they're already up there?
They've just gone for reconnoiter around the base of the mountains.
Right, they're not going all the way up. They don't know about this yet.
The Germans already know about it.
The Germans know about it, but they can't do anything about it at the moment.
The German aircraft can't make it up over the mountains. You know that because the Junkers are a very powerful aircraft, but they don't have the ability to go up at the altitude required.
Right.
All right, Sean, how many people can I carry up? How many people can the plane safely carry?
I think it's somewhere close to 10 or so.
That's gonna make pretty tight because you're pretty much gonna get one shot at this.
Six.
Yeah, you're talking about us. Just us.
No. There's one other thing, gentlemen. Once again, our witness is unreliable. However, if what we are to believe here, what caused this slaughter in our camp was these creatures, as you said, Nigel. That the creatures then proceeded to try to get home, which they would have thought was that plateau city up there. Along the way, once those creatures had entered the city, they made an attempt. Apparently there is an entire sea, a warm sea, that is beneath the city. As they attempted to get there, they were waylaid by something, possibly one of these amoeba creature things, and it murdered them all, tore their heads off. So
murdered two of the creatures?
Murdered the creatures, killed them.
All right, well,
there may be animosity between these Shoggoth things and the Elder things. And Dire says that they were chased through the city by these amoeba creatures and just barely escaped with their lives.
But amoebas are tiny, surely.
They described it as the size of a bus.
Regardless, if we're going up there, we're going up there fully armed.
Yes, we need to be fully armed, possibly with explosives.
Speak of the devil, you hear a rumbling noise of an aircraft approaching.
The devil's coming. We can hear him coming.
And Acacia Lexington's aircraft, the Bell, loops around and turns, lands. The door flies open, and she comes storming right towards your group because she sees you first.
Okay.
She storms over. She was.
Miss Lexington, you seem speechless at the moment.
Ah. Almost frozen in time.
Am I okay now?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're okay now.
She says, "Where's your illustrious leader? He tried to kill us, and I need to speak to him right now."
Our leader? Sparky? He's back at the ship.
Back.
No. No, who's Beck, our leader?
Professor Moore. That's who she's speaking of.
Professor Moore is in his tent, ma'am.
Well, she's thank you, and she storms off.
We're heading that direction ourselves. So.
Too bad he was unsuccessful.
Well, feel free to tag along. I have a word or two for him.
We're following right behind her because we need to talk to him.
Okay. Once she learns, she heads right to his tent, demands to see him. He doesn't want to see anybody, whoever one of the junior peoples outside, and she bursts in anyways, and he speaks distractedly to her. He apologizes. She explains in a very firm way that the oxygen they gave her for their flight was not pure. It had a terrible smell, and everyone had headaches and nausea from trying to use it. And they had to dive back down to a lower altitude. They couldn't get up to 16,000 feet to take the photographs they wanted to take.
Well, so excuse me, the oxygen came from the Germans.
Well, she's on. Did it?
Yeah, they're the ones with the oxygen to go up that high.
The Germans have oxygen equipment, but we had our own because we
were right.
the oxygen mask training on the ship.
Yeah, it was filled.
This brings up another issue of possible sabotage.
Right.
Yes, it was filled in Australia. Melbourne. Yes.
Melbourne, I believe. So she goes off, storming off to see Meyer. She's so mad she doesn't want to talk. She just heads off towards the German camp.
We need to test all of the oxygen to see what it's like.
Yeah, we're going to have to test our oxygen because I don't want to make this ascent.
No.
Is there by chance, like, do we have a compressor if we can compress more?
It takes more than just a compressor to make oxygen.
Yeah, you don't have a compressor because, and even if you did, you'd be compressing just air into the tanks. It wouldn't be pure oxygen. And shortly after this, just so you know, the Junkers aircraft returns that departed earlier in the day, and they start to unload. They've got 18 drums of fuel they've been unloading.
We want to discuss with Moore the phases that we think that we need to go through, that we need to go up and survey, and then eventually fly up there.
Well, he says, "Gentlemen, I'd like to wait till after dinner, so please, 8 o'clock, if you would, we can meet then."
All right. Yes, sir.
Okay, so here's the thing is, we need to, and there's really no democratic way to do this, we need to decide if we're going to do this, we need to bring a plan to him on who's going. My plane will fit 6 people. Is that including the pilot?
Yes.
6 people. And that's it. And there's six of us.
Well, then let's be practical about it. We need the surveyor.
We need the surveyor, we need Sugden, and we need me. There's no way around that. You have to have those three.
And if you're just doing a flyby, I mean, I'm happy to wait until...
No. This is talking about a landing party. The survey is just going to be me and Elmer and Sugden, because that's all we need for that. Right. If we're just going to do a flyby. But if we're going to land...
Well, yeah, then everybody's in, I assume.
Gregory needs to go. He's the archaeologist. Moore actually is a geologist. He probably does not need to go. Unless he insists on going, then we're stuck with him.
Tie him to the roof.
I'm a paleontologist. Quite honestly, I'd have to really come up with some justification for going, but at the moment, I'm expendable.
Honestly, so is Dr. Hawks.
That's probably true.
I wouldn't want to go up there without medical support.
Well, here's the big point that I'm trying to make. The Germans are going to come to us, and they gave us this information. Are the Germans going to insist on having a member in? Because their oxygen would sure be nice. And since we are assuming that the Germans are the ones that were doing all of the sabotage, their oxygen would be clean.
Well, we have.
I'm not trying to get rid of anybody in the party.
We have more than one airplane. We do have more than one airplane and more than one pilot.
And she has her own aircraft.
I thought hers couldn't make it up either, though.
Oh, no, it's the German aircraft that can't make it up.
Hers are American built.
Her plane is our plane because I flew her in here.
But we had three planes of our own.
Now, we only brought two with us.
Oh, no. She has the Bell, which can carry six people. There's the Enderby, which can carry 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 as well. And the Weddell, which can also carry six.
Then why did the bitch ride with me?
Split up the group. She didn't have fuel, so.
Well, I would suggest that we include, if we've got the space for the extra people, I would suggest we include a couple of Germans with guns.
You think they're better shots than we are?
No, but they have military equipment, whereas then we have a scattering of assorted civilian rifles.
Do they have military equipment?
Couple stormtroopers.
Right. I think that we should talk to Moore, and I mean he'll probably want to organize some of this himself. But it looks like we can get at least 18 people up there. And I would like to be part of that, but once again, I'm not an archaeologist, and I'm a paleontologist, but...
Well, that's all well and good, but there's also the fact that we should probably minimize the number of people who have access to that document. Now, you and Dr. Hawks have already read the document. That's two people who've read the document. If we replace you on the mission, that's two more people who need to read the document.
Well, that's up to Mr. Moore. He's the one who gave it to us. I hope that he wants us to go along, but...
I mean, given that we're dealing with life forms that are potentially millions of years old, I would say that your expertise has proven valuable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, but... Well, like I say, let's let Moore make those decisions. There is another paleontologist, and there's some other scientists. We might consider that we really need somebody who knows a lot about high altitude, cold weather survival. I don't know what's going on. GM, correct me if I'm wrong, but okay. One of the things that they pointed out was, as I recall in the story, that once they got down into the city, it wasn't necessarily as cold as it is on the surface, because there is a warm sea underneath it. But I could be wrong about that.
Well, I think it's... I do have numbers, just outside of game for a moment. I have the numbers of the temperatures and such, yes, but I'm prepared.
Okay.
Yes, I think you are correct.
Okay.
Let's just get to the conversation with Moore, because that's really going to be what decides what.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, he comes out, he says, gentlemen, I can actually speak earlier now. This is fine. This is fine. I'm settled. I've recuperated mentally from my issues earlier in the day. Well, I just, if you could all come in my tent, that would be fine.
We give him our recommendations. And I explained, you know, we shared it with these members because we needed to ask them questions about the feasibility of.
Yeah, I expected you would. I've come to my own conclusions as well. So, what do you think of the document, just yourselves? What do you think of the accuracy of it?
Honestly, I don't think that it matters if the guy is mad, Looney Tunes, office rock, or whatever. I don't really think that it matters, because the creatures we know are real. We can't take and not take that chance. We can't just assume he's crazy and write him off. We have to know.
Well, I agree.
Realize, too, the chance you're taking. We're in an environment that can kill you in 5 minutes. And this is an even bigger risk.
But all we're talking about is a flyover. That's where
we're starting.
Yeah. That's where we're starting. So nothing.
I have other things. I have thoughts. We're prepared for this. We are prepared. I'll put this to the others, of course, but it would please me greatly if you were in the first flight over the mountains. There will be times for the others later, once we know. But there's important questions we have to work out. Who should come to the city on the first run? What equipment should we bring? How much of anything should we tell Mr. Starkweather? I mean, he hasn't been here. He hasn't seen this. He hasn't read this. He's been off on his little adventure. Should Miss Lexington be shown the manuscript? Can the Germans be trusted? I wonder so much.
Well, the Germans have shared the manuscript with us.
True.
Well, I think that before we get into any real discussion, I think that we're going to have to do a survey. We're going to have to do a flyover and see if I can even land up there.
Phase one, do the survey. Phase two, go up there and explore. As far as Mr. Starkweather and Miss Lexington, I think that they are showboaters. I don't think that they're real scientists. I think that it's up to your discretion whether you explain all of this to them. But if you do explain it to them, I'm afraid that they're going to be up there showboating rather than actually doing anything constructive.
Well, what about Mr. Starkweather, though? What should we do about him?
Nothing. He's not here.
But he's coming back. He's leaving soon.
Then why would I suggest we get going before he gets here?
Well, I could suggest, yeah, that we could do our survey before he gets here. But we could also try to make him realize that he needs to keep it a secret too. Not just go blabbing away to everybody. We don't even know if we're going to find anything. There's the thing. We don't know if there's anything up there. This could be the rantings of a madman. Dyer is not Dyer. Who survived? Who got back? Was it Dyer who got back? Yeah. And he's in a nut house.
I don't think it went that far.
No, I don't believe so. Somebody's
in a nut house.
Oh, there are definitely there's people who've been affected in a negative way. I can tell you exactly.
Danforth is the one that went mad.
But Danforth
went crazy.
Well, that's I think that's the way we should break it down. Phase one, go up there and survey. Phase two, actually go up there and explore.
Yes.
Phase three, well, what we usually do, take over and enslave the population.
Phase four, the ants develop mass. Oh, no.
I'll tell you what, I need to think of this over the night. So we'll reconvene in the morning and I'll have my decision by then. I'm speaking with some of the other pilots as well, and I will decide based on your information and my own thoughts what we'll do, because tomorrow's the day we have to make that decision before Mr. Starkweather gets back. I want to be firm in our decision and tell him this is what we're doing and not give him the opportunity to sway us from our decisions before we arrive. Thank you very much. Everyone, please enjoy your dinner and have a good sleep.
Good night, Mr. Moore. Professor. Doctor.
Now, outside of game, Bill needs to go, I think he said.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to call
it
there?
When did you want to call it?
It's up to you guys. This is a good point. If it's okay, it'll be a little short, but it's up to you.
Yeah, let's call it there.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thank you.
Our players included Jerry Bryant, Greg Malcolm, Bill Mize, Mick Swan, Jeff Wilkins, and myself, with Sean Little as the Keeper of the Secrets. Our musical intro, Sleight of Hand, was composed by James Brett and is used with his permission. We're currently producing four shows a week with music and sound effects added in post-production in order to create a richer listener experience. We provide audio-only versions of our show free for you to download from Podbean or iTunes. Patrons of our show can now enjoy recordings of our pre- and post-game conversations. Some of the funniest and most interesting stuff occurs during that time. If you'd like to become a patron, visit our Patreon account. Just $1 or $2 a month will help us a lot. Like, share, and subscribe to our channel for updates on our latest shows, and leave us some comments. We love reading them. This is Tom Rayleigh, together with all the members of our gaming club, inviting you to journey with us once again into the darkness for another adventure into the universe of H.P. Lovecraft and the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. Until next time, good luck and good gaming.